but it assumed very serious proportions as of after the death of Lenin. When Lenin was alive, there wasn't this kind of persecution. And I must honestly say that during the life of Lenin, there were hundreds of schools in the Soviet Union where they taught even in Yiddish. They taught in Yiddish mathematics and physics and this and this. Lenin had a different outlook entirely, but Stalin, as you know, he was the most brutal despot, and they wanted to wipe out any vestige of the cultures and the religion and the language of any minority. And this assumed very serious proportions, and especially they were opposed to religion. They felt that once you will uproot religion, you will not have any kind of a semblance of national roots of any of the minorities. And this war, of course, against religion goes on even now.
Were the conditions under Stalin much worse than those under the Tsar?
Yes. Oh, yes. Under the Tsar, there were restrictions. There were pogroms. But under the Tsar, there were thousands of synagogues, tens of thousands of religious functionaries, rabbis, shochtim, and teachers. And however difficult it was, over 5 million Jews produced by way of Hebrew, Yiddish literature, rabbinic scholarship, something which has no parallel in the annals of modern Jewish history, or even since the Middle Ages. They had the largest, the leading rabbinical colleges, yeshivot, what we call. And don't forget that from Tsarist Russia came forth people like Ben-Gurion, like Chaim Weizmann, like Maya Berlin, like Shatak, all of the giants of the Zionist movement, with all of the restrictions, and there were highly educated people like Nahum Sokolov. They are the cornerstone of Zionism and of the State of Israel, Golda Meir, and so forth. So certainly under Stalin it was much, much worse. No question about it. Oh, I love the person when I talk.
No, I just wanted that on the tape.
Oh.
Now the tape's going along.
You see, the cultural, religious, and Zionist contribution of Russian Jewry is so messy. It's so enormous. It has no parallel. Almost in every conceivable area of Jewish creativity, they excel. And we owe a tremendous debt to this community, who gave us so much by way of letters, by way of Zionism, by way of scholarship, by way of the Hebrew language, in all of these areas.
Oh. Economic, you told us about. Cultural, you told us about. Disciplines, I don't know just what they mean by disciplines. So can you tell me, Natalie?
I'm really interested in the economic before we get onto that. I know life was very difficult,
yes.
But how, because of the restrictions the government put on you,
yes.
How did you manage financially?
How did we manage? Well, first of all, in the city where we lived, there were quite a few Jewish people who were not as restricted as we are, and there was a very human generosity to the needs of the rabbi of the community. This is number one. Number two, help came from the United States of America. American Jews and those organizations which existed then, they were aware that there was a famine in Russia. They were aware that Jews are being discriminated against, and especially those who are in the category of non-citizens, like rabbis, educators, Zionists, and others. And I do remember once before Passover, we did not know what's going to be. We're not going to have matzah. And suddenly, 3 days before Passover, I remember we got 3 small packages of flour from the United States. And this is what saved us. And we had flour. We had matzah for Passover. And they also, during the height of the famine, they, from the United States, food came in. However meager, and canned milk or this, This helped out very much, and it kept us from starving.
From what source did it come in the United States?
The United States, like JDC.
Oh,
the,
ages,
it was from
yeah.
organized. Yeah. It was from the organized Jewish community. And really, they have been very generous, and they understood the need. And they sent packages. They sent to keep people packages for distribution to other needy Jews, too. And it came to our city, just as it came to other cities in Russia.
Did the Jewish Welfare Board, they were functioning at that time, were they involved?
As a youngster, I remember especially the Joint Distribution Committee.
Yes.
I remember that things that used to come from there. And then something else, there were private Jews, friends or relatives, who sent packages. And this was a tremendous help. So all in all, but really the organization, the Jewish organization of which we knew in Russia,
mm-hmm.
in America, was the Joint Distribution.
Which they used to call the Joint.
Yeah, that is how they call it.
You had said that you lived in such a large house. Was that owned by the synagogue?
This was built for the rabbi. It was a historic community, and the house was perhaps 80 years old. It was a beautiful place, a palatial place. And everything, the furniture, all of our belongings, everything was left as it is. So that there wouldn't be any suspicion that we left the house. And we were successful. People couldn't get over it, could hardly believe that we got out alive. My father was marked. And it's one of those miracles.
And the house was furnished to you, given to you.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Through the Soviets.
No, by the Jewish community.
Oh, by the Jewish
synagogue.
Community.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there were still synagogues. When we left in our city, they closed quite a few synagogues. But when we left, I would say at least some 11 or 13 synagogues were still functioning.
You could have held services right in your home.
Yes, but it was very difficult because if a Jew had a job with the government and he was caught entering the synagogue, he lost his job. Even now in Moscow, a man who is an engineer. You know, I went back 3 times. I took a chance on my life. I'll show you letters from the State Department that in the long run, they said, you are taking a chance by going back to Russia. They can claim you as a citizen because in a way you left also illegally Russia. But I went back 3 times. And whenever I spoke to Jews in Moscow, in Leningrad, in Tbilisi, in Odessa, in Kiev, they told me the same stories we had. They would like to go into the synagogue, but if they'll be seen or caught by an agent, he will lose his job.
Were any of your brothers drafted?
No, because the older ones were sent out, and we were left the younger ones, so we were not in the age.
So no one was there at the
time. Not
park.
In the age.
That's how many Jewish people came to the United States.
But during those days, during those days, very few Jews left Russia.
They couldn't.
Very small, an incredibly small number. Very in the hundreds a year, not even in the thousands, in the hundreds in a year. That's all.
Well,
I'm
right.
talking about the 30s.
Yes.
The dark Stalin era. Then it was only in the hundreds. You check up with any of the records in the United States, you'll see it. Take here in 1973 alone. We got some 32,000 Jews from the Soviet Union in Israel. And, of course, in the United States, we expect this year perhaps some 15,000 that will come in the next 12 months, according to our data. I'm digressing. Yes.
Is the Save Soviet Jewry project netting great results now, would you say?
Everything which is done in the free world to arouse public opinion is of help. I personally know and I believe that if not for the protests, if not for the efforts of Jews in America and the United Kingdom, we would have not had so many thousands of Jews come out of Russia. The Soviet Union is very sensitive to public opinion. And when I brought about this idea, you know, probably it's my idea to save Soviet Jewry. We started off in Pittsburgh, and then we started off in other communities. And temples, everyone went. Jewish community centers, everyone. Unfortunately, our sign here came up with a wind, and we're getting a new one. Now, and I started off this idea. I sent out then the letters to the Rabbinate of America, and it went over very well, and the Soviets are very much annoyed. When we do things which annoys them very much, it is occasionally productive. I don't say always, but it is. And therefore, anything we can do to keep alive this issue, and we must keep it alive because we are of a generation which lost 6 million Jews to Auschwitz, and the Soviet Union has over 3.5 million Jews now. This is the second largest Jewish community in the world. And therefore, we must do everything, anything, to keep the problem alive.
They are coming at little by little. Does that answer your question, Natalie? The disciplines. I wasn't sure that I knew what they meant, but do you know what they mean by disciplines?
Yes,
it's on question two, the last word.
Yeah, home atmosphere, religious, economic, culture.
Well, how your family, how your parents handled.
Yes, of course, there was in our home an intensive religious discipline. No question about it. And this is how my parents succeeded in combating the very, very vigorous anti-religious climate on the outside by having a very intensive religious discipline within the house. So in the United States, let us say that there isn't very much religion in the climate, but there isn't anti-religion. In the Soviet Union, it is very vigorous, the anti-Semitic. And yet, because of the religious discipline at home, my parents succeeded in conveying to us the tradition of Judaism and keeping it and preserving it.
Isn't that amazing? Now, we have this third question, the life of the community of birth and developmental period. Well, I think you've more or less covered that in the background that you've given us.
Right.
It says contrast it with Pittsburgh, if possible.
Yes.
How in the world?
Well, I would contrast it with Pittsburgh. First of all, even during those dark days, there was a higher level of religious commitment and religious observance, and also awareness of your Jewishness. Secondly, even under the repressive measures of the Stalin regime, Jewish parents did go out of the way to give children secretly some kind of a meaningful Jewish education. They have tried their best to convey that tradition to them. And then, of course, I also want to mention that these people, the adults, they were remnants of a previous generation. And scholarship was terribly important. Scholarship was the path for Jewish leadership, for Jewish recognition, and aristocracy meant scholarship. These two words were synonymous. So there was that intensive atmosphere to learn. There was this desire to preserve tradition even under most insurmountable circumstances. And it is also interesting to know that there was a very strong Zionist feeling. The more dark the repressive measures against Jews were under the Stalin era, the more Jews reacted and they wanted to know about Palestine and the future. But at the same time, I must say something which is not paradoxical, but very interesting, painfully interesting. There was a substantial element of Jews who were very enthusiastic about communism and about the new regime, and they have joined enthusiastically the Communist Party, And there was especially a group of Jews known as the Yevsektsiya, abbreviation of the Russian name Yevreyskaya Sektsiya Kommunistichesskoy Partii Sovyetskogo Soyuza, which meant the Jewish section of the Communist Party of the USSR. And they sent a telegram from our own community, the Jewish communists, congratulating the Arabs in 1929 when they made the pogrom and they killed off many Jews, and especially many students of the Hebron Yeshiva. So they congratulated them. And I want to say that those Jewish communists, they were very vigorous, and they were very devoted to the government, and some of them did not mind executing fellow Jews, even as other citizens were executed for minor infractions of the Stalinist code or the Stalinist law, whatever it might have been. And I do know that occasionally my father, as rabbi of the community, had to go and plead with former students of his not to shoot a certain woman. They found in, on her premises sugar, and they wanted to know how she got it, and they accused her of contraband, and she was taken out to be shot. And my father went and he interceded. She had younger children, and they did not have it. She was shot, and she was executed. And then there were Jewish communists who took some of the wealthiest Jews, and they put them in bags, and they browned them in the Tzvina. They put them in alive, and they browned them. And in a way, you have to understand their psychology. Life for Jews in Tsarist Russia was not depicted. There was the Pale of Settlement. Many, many Jews were denied rights of residence in many metropolitan areas. They were squeezed together in certain areas where it was totally impossible to develop a viable economic or material existence. And there were many who were very, very suppressed, repressed, and especially those who were workers, the tailor, the shoemaker, the artisans, and others. Communism gave them a new lease on life. Communism gave them a promise of education. Communism gave them a promise of acceptance and equality. And they became very enthusiastic, and I will not deny the Jews, you know it yourself, played a very prominent role in the revolution to overthrow the Tsar. And the Tsar, of course, was a vicious anti-Semite. When the Tsar was arrested by the revolutionaries, they found on his night paper the protocols of the elders of Tsar. The Tsar himself directed the tragic trial of Beilis in 1913 in Kiev, when he was accused of slaughtering a Christian child for blood for Pesach. So you could not blame some of these young Jews, and some of these socialists, they went to Israel later on. Golda Meir was in that group too. They abhorred, they hated that system. And because of their suffering, and because of their humiliation after the revolution, when they tasted freedom and freedom of mobility and whatnot, they became even more enthusiastic. I'll never forget when I walked to Moscow on Saturday from the synagogue on my second return to my native land. I passed by a big monument in the square, and it was Sverdlov, named for Jacob's Sverdlov, Yaakov Sverdlov, and he was a Jew, a prominent Jewish revolutionary, Trotsky. Many of the luminaries of the ideologies, the theoreticians, they were Jews. And many of them took very seriously the communist system, communist law, the communist propaganda measures. And they did, I wouldn't say collaborate. Collaborate is an ugly word. This means when your enemy comes to do. They cooperated. They were enthusiastic because this is how they felt about it. So this was an exciting time, exciting, painfully exciting, I would say, for me as a young boy to grow up in Bialystok, in my homeland. I remember, for example, we had a shochet, you know, a ritual slaughtering. A Hasidic Jew, always with a long beard, with the earlocks, with a long cotton. And one day, the newspaper announces that the Shochet Arnella is going to address the working class of the Jews in the club of the shoemakers. Friday night, it was packed over 1,000 people. And here comes up a new man. When you see somebody always with a beard, you know, no beard, no yarmulke, no hat, no cotton, European attire, and he comes up and he says, I don't believe in God. I never believed in God. The Bible is anti-Semitic. And he started quoting things. You know, an ultra-Orthodox Jew turning this way. Why? Because for weeks before that, they took his hand and they squeezed, they broke all of his fingers in between the door. You understand? And he could not take it anymore. They just beat him up and this and this until he changed. And this was done with quite a few Jews. Those methods of torture go on even now. There are Jews who, very prominent Jews, who apply. Didn't you see Susskind show with the 5 second Jews?
No.
Oh, it was twice already in Pittsburgh. Sunday and last week, Tuesday night. And nowadays, I just spoke to Jew in Moscow last week. His brother is in an insane asylum because he's a big mathematician. The Soviets don't want to let him out from Russia, so they declared him insane. And they put him in a bed with two demented people. Do you know what kind of a torture it is? I have to go up only once in a while to the Western psychiatric and spend time with some patients that I go out broken, I'm shattered when I go out from there. But imagine when you put somebody in a bed in between two demented people. And this is the kind of torture they give you now. I have seen Jews arrived in Israel and they took off their shirts and they showed to me the wounds and the scars inflicted by them by Soviet police. And those methods still continue. So this is the kind of a life we live. Secrecy, hiding from police, running away from police. My father was running away and hiding from police over 12, 14 continuous months in Moscow and Leningrad. We didn't know whether he was alive. And then when he came back in the middle of the night, bang on the door, search, arrested for 2 months. You don't know where he is. My father was arrested over a dozen times like this. And my mother had to go through the agony of going and looking whether he's alive or where he is and this. This is how we were brought up. This was our youth. This was our childhood.
The Jews who became very active in the Communist Party,
yes.
Then, did any of them remain as observant Jews?
Only a few, and very secretly, like the Marano Jews of Spain under the Inquisition. Do you know what they used to do? This was time when you couldn't get bread. Look, Soviet Russia now, 1976, when they sent up the first Sputnik. And they are doing phenomenal. They are challenging us in nuclear atomic weapons and whatnot. And even now they don't have enough bread to eat. In many communities they are starving. And they have to buy bread from us in Canada. And if they wouldn't buy from us, it would be terrible. Imagine how it was 40 years ago, 30 years ago. The famine was terrible. Now we couldn't get any bread to eat. It was a terrible problem. And they would give you bread if you came in school on Yom Kippur. To make a party, the Jewish communists would make a party in Yom Kippur to desecrate it and to tear out from the child any semblance of religious loyalty. We couldn't get bread otherwise, but they would make for the night of the Seder a big party and make you eat bread, and then they had bread for you, to give it to you. They would take out scrolls of the Torah on the street and not only burn them, but first they would desecrate, they would make garbage of it. And in order to tear out from the child everything. And my own schoolmates, they used to say, you are the son of the enemy. You are the son of the spy. You are the son of the thief. You are the son of this. A rabbi, and I will say that the same treatment was for rabbi and a person. Truthfully. I mean, I will not tell you that it was different. Anyone in religion was in trouble and suffering. So this is how we were brought up. It was a dark night. It was a mirage. It was something unbelievable that children could have survived. And this is why they call us the Stalin children.
And yet you never abandoned your religion? You never
No,
attempted?
I did not. I did not, I hate to tell you this, but I will tell you this. And this will show you as to what kind of a faith. I'm not telling it to you in a subjective way now, what I'm going to tell you. It's very brief. But in a general way, so that you will have an understanding what a home can do to a child by way of religion. When we left for the United States on the St. Louis, the notorious St. Louis German boat, which had those Jewish refugees, about 1,100 in the United States would not let them in, and then the Nazis put it down, you know, on the deck of the ocean. So you heard of the St. Louis. Now we came with the St. Louis to the United States, but some of us in the family got very, very sick on the boat. And I was miserably sick. So then my mother comes over, and I was running high fever, and I couldn't touch any food. And nothing, you know, here, we went through so much, all of this. And my mother was sitting near me, and she is a very, very strong person. Very, very strong, and of course everyone will try to describe his mother a very special thing. But this is the truth. She is a mother who can take and pack three youngsters and send them across the boundary, not knowing whether she's going to see them or not, for the sake of Judaism. So my mother, suddenly she, with her hands at Kippah, was compassionate. Why is it that we deserve such? So much agony and pain. So I said to my mother in Yiddish, you don't understand Yiddish, I'll give it to you right away in English. I said, I'll tell you why, mother, why we deserve it. Because we have no right to leave our Jews in the nation alone. Because my father and all of us, we should have remained to suffer together with them. And therefore God is punishing us now on the boat. And this is the kind, this was said by a youngster, 14 years old. My mother always reminds it to me. And this was our commitment, which we got wrong. It wasn't just I, because of my intelligence or my sensitivity or this. Any boy brought up this way would have probably said,
okay. Imagine that.
But would you just, you were on the ship that was refused admittance to this country?
No. Later on, there were other Jews, you remember, under the Nazis, and they refused to let them in. It came to Miami, and they wouldn't let them off. They had to go back, and they sunk with all the Jews.
What ship were you on? Where did you sail
we
from?
We came with the settlers from Hamburg. We had to go to Hamburg, Germany.
But when you were on the boat, you came. You were on.
Oh, yes, sure. We came to New York, but wait, something interesting. So we come, and the government officials say, well, this we have no relations with the Soviet Union, and your passport doesn't look so proper. And we were arrested. That was my welcome to the United States on Ellis Island. And we were kept in separate rooms. I, as a young boy, was put in with three Chinese who were to be returned back to China. And I spent there 16 days alone in a room on Ellis Island because the United States and the Soviet Union had no diplomatic relations. You remember, the diplomatic relations came under FDR. You remember, in 1934, he gave recognition that there is a Soviet Union, which was so stupid on the part of the United States. Here was a reality, a state and suffered. And we were arrested.
With China.
And I will not go into our suffering on Ellis Island. What kind of a terrible, traumatic thing it was. I believe one of my sisters still is occasionally sick on account of this experience. They tore us away, each one from the family. They broke up the family. And they probably thought that my mother was a spy, or that we are Russian spies. And we were detained on the island for 16 days for no reason at all. Well, and people had to work on, they got us out. So we had family, we had friends, they were not even aware. And this was our coming here. Go ahead.
Where was your father at this point? Was he with you
my,
or was
no,
he
my father
here?
Went ahead of us 2 months, and he was in St. Louis. But because it was a holiday, he could not travel to meet us in New York. So a first cousin of his came to meet us. Very fine person, everything. But suddenly the officials there decided that there's something wrong, it's Russian passports. And they had very few people coming in from Soviet Union. So they were very suspicious, you know, perhaps there are communists and this. And they detained us. 16 days. I would not eat their food, I remember, so I had to live on sunshine crackers and milk, which was not so bad. You could exist
after what you hadn't
this
had.
Wasn't,
all those
this
years.
Wasn't so bad. I remember I spent my time sewing. There was a person who came in and gave occupational thing, you know. So they taught me how to do some sewing. That's what I did.
So the relative from St. Louis finally got to you.
Oh, yes.
And
they
finally,
took us up and they apologized later on. They said it was a misunderstanding. They couldn't read the Russian papers and this and that. But this is the weather over
here. The immigration authorities made lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
Many mistakes.
We forgave them. We're not angry.
Yeah. You're here now.
Yeah.